Chapter 29. Augustine was all smiles now that Ianthe the First had passed her final hurdle. His open delight did a lot to ameliorate the reddened, swelling tension that had permeated the Mithraeum. You found his frank and open relief patronizing, but your sister Lycta did not, or at least made a very good show of enjoying it. You went to watch a bout between them in the training rooms, sitting quietly and holding your rapier. It was full of unnecessary formality, even to your ninth house eyes, all antique niceties and duelling condescension that had been long forgotten back home. Ianthe was a saint of the third house, and Augustine an antique of the fifth. Neither did anything without putting down a little carpet first and introducing themselves to an audience of 1,000 quiet-eyed memorial bones, and you. But after the ceremony came the sword. You remembered so little of Nibiria's turn, either of his death or of his life. But from what you had gathered, he would have been the last cavalier in the whole starless universe to think his sword arm better off defleshed. Despite that, Ianthe was cured. It had been your faintest and most childlike hope that Ianthe would consider your bondage over, that your saving her life would be enough to release you from the collar of debt she had placed around your neck. "As if," she'd said, "when I ask, you will know you have been asked, Nona Jesimus." The saint of patience had held to his promise to gild the arm, and now you often caught Ianthe marvelling at her metal-shod finger bones, at the buttery shine of gold upon her triquetrum. Your eldest sister, whose discomfort and annoyance only grew with Augustine's delight, confronted you about it in the corridors. "Did you really erect that ghastly edifice?" "Yes," you said.
"And it's really self-synthesizing bone?"
"Yes," you said.
"Though I wouldn't call the process synthesis when the construct is merely perpetually growing to fill a pre-realized skeletal map. It's yet more proof that topological resonance can be manipulated."
Mercy Morn's eyes narrowed to hurricane slits with short, thick lashes. Her prismatically white Canaanite robe was wrapped very tightly around her, as though she were cold, and she had bound back her peach-coloured hair as though it were a wimple. She said,
"I see."
And then,
"I see, I see. What's 2 plus 2?
4.
Smallest bone in the body. The auditory ossicles, but what's the name of the saint of duty?"
You said,
"Autus the First,"
and you were too slow. She reached out and tapped you on the side of the head. What Mercy Morn the First could do with a simple tap on the side of the head might have meant your end far more easily than the saint of duty, a run-up, and his spear. But she said out loud,
"Autus,"
and then hurriedly again, all in one single, "Autus.
Autus."
The back of your skull ached, and you felt the chilly stab of pain in your sinuses that you sometimes felt in the dry atmosphere of the Mithraeum. You jerked away. Your fingers flew to the bone studs in your ears. But she was not attacking you. You, so aware of your body, could sense no gland overworking, nor chemical coursing, nor vessel constricting. The only change was in Mercy. Her placid oval face had taken on much the same look as you had seen, through a thin veil of viscera, the day you had fed the lictors your own marrow. She looked at you, quiet, and perhaps even a little lost, and she said,
"I can't tell if you're a once-in-a-lifetime genius, an insane imbecile, or both."
Then she said,
"Children as fists. Infants as gestures. Yuck! Phew! I live in the worst of all possible worlds."
And without saying another word, Mercy Morn stalked off down the corridor in the opposite direction, the lights making rainbows of her tightly shrouded robes. When you reported this conversation to Ianthe, she was not particularly interested. This was, you thought, your sister saint's downfall. She had predefined a set of things that merited her attention and consideration, and everything else she put aside. You brood over everything, she had said once to this accusation. You read unholy omens in the way people say good morning. She's a crank, said Ianthe. Augustine says she went funny years ago, and that much like a stopped clock, she's right twice a day by coincidence. Avoid, avoid. How you loathed any sentence beginning with, Augustine says.
But she touched my head, you said. She was changing something, or looking for something, and I have no idea what.
Your brain, suggested Ianthe. Later, you lay together in her lavish bed, far apart enough that if you reached out your hand, you might just brush her with your fingertips. It was, you had admitted, the only place you now felt safe to sleep, what with your wards so eminently destroyable. The mockery you endured for needing her proximity was exquisitely painful, but humiliation was steadily becoming your existence whole and entire. But sleeping side by side was awkward. It had been her idea. You would have slept on the carpet if you hadn't thought it would leave you more vulnerable to the saint of duty. It would have been too easy to see you from the window in the case of a space-side assault. Trauma prevented you from simply taking a pillow and sleeping in the bathtub. You lay flat on your back in borrowed blankets, wearing third-hand clothes. Ianthe had given you a daffodil-coloured nightgown, rummaged from some ancient drawer of artifacts belonging to a long-dead lictor's cavalier. It made you look like a liver inflammation. You stared glumly at a painting opposite the bed of an exquisite woman with lots of ruddy golden hair, a dreamy smile and no clothes, though she was holding a rapier, and, for no reason you could see, a melon. That first night in her bed, you'd placed your bone-dressed sword between you and felt better. She had, unsurprisingly, ragged you for it. Relax, she had said. I haven't invited you to an orgy, Harrow. From this lying-down angle, the painting of the nude and obstreperously beautiful woman was in full sightline. You had murmured, I believe you, albeit many wouldn't. This is why I cultivate you, Harrow Hark, she had remarked. The suspicion that you might possess a sense of humour. You had said, I'm not so gullible to think that your only reason. Of course I want something from you, but it's not personal, Ianthe had said. Understand me, Harry. I always take the smartest option first. Burn any bridges that need to be burned. Try to get in before anyone else can. It was the first thing I ever admired about you, back at, well, I promised not to talk about that. I'm very good at seeing the big picture, and your being alive is, right now, part of my big picture. Both of you had stared in the bedtime silence of blankets and darkness at the big picture in front of you. They're all self-portraits, you know, she had said gloomily. Cyrus the First and his cavalier constantly painted portraits of themselves and each other in the nude, hung them up everywhere, and gave them out to people for their birthdays. Augustine said Cyrus had them all brought over from Canaan House. Why do you keep them around? It is the type of energy I wish to take into my future, Ianthe had said. You both lay now in the low blue habitation light of the sleeping hours, not so close that you could semantically be said to be lying together. You were very aware of her nonetheless, of her skimmed milk hair and discontented mouth, and of the amber satin she wore that made her arm so gold and her veins so green. The Saint of Duty is killable, she said. You've shown that you're capable of killing him, even if you're not a genuine lictor. So, if it were up to me, he'd be dead already. You did not remotely believe this. The real problem is Teacher. I'm not sure you can kill Ortus quickly enough to avoid Teacher bursting through the wall with a merry, not on my watch, and bringing him back from a death blow. You said, then what do you propose? Distracting God? That is exactly what I propose, said Ianthe. At the sound you made, she continued eagerly, I mean it. Augustine says he'll do it. I asked him as a favour to me, and he said yes.
Augustine said yes. Augustine agreed to the murder of his brother Lictor.
There are very complex power dynamics on this station, said your sister Lictor, with whom you had a very complex power dynamic. I told him the whole story. Don't make that face, Harry, it'll stick that way. And he said Ortus was on too long a leash, and what he thought he was doing, Augustine didn't know, but that gunning for you was stupid when you're just going to be eaten by heralds anyway. Sorry, direct quote. You said flatly, I appreciate the sentiment. In any case, he said they can get by with just 3 lictors to take down number 7. So if I can step into Ortus's shoes now that I'm not problematic, you can see I took my lumps, Nona Jesimus. He can buy you an hour after dinner.
When?
Tomorrow.
How?
Didn't say. But it's Augustine the First, my child. He's the first and oldest lictor. These 3 are all the oldest and the last. That's why they're patience, joy, and duty. 3 virtues. If Augustine is going to distract God, that means he's going to distract God. He's very old, and I hate to admit it, but he's enormously quick and sophisticated and devious. Anyway, I've taken care of him, and he'll take care of Teacher, and you'll take care of duty.
You've really ensured this?
Fight him and win, Harry. Call it payment for the arm.
You sound surprised.
You found yourself murmuring, almost more surprised with yourself than with her.
Warrior proud of the 3rd house, ride forth now as my sister.
There was a rustle from her side of the bed, and you saw that she had sat up a little, her exposed and metal-skinned humerus garishly propped on the covers.
Was that poetry? She demanded. Debatably, you said,
and she lay back down. Then you said,
I accept your help. I am forced to admit that I cannot do this alone.
I live for your forced admissions, said Ianthe. It would have been a pain if you'd said no. I've already organised everything. You both fell silent. The canopy of the 4-poster bed obscured the fresco on the over-decorated ceiling, which was a relief to the eye. Her covers were softer than the covers in your room, though you thought the mattress too squashy for real comfort. One sank down into it like a bog. You were not used to so many pillows, nor were you used to the slippery chill of satin on your skin, nor were you used to hearing someone else's breath insubstantial beside you. For a moment you thought Ianthe had fallen asleep. Then she said idly, Coronabeth and I spent 3 nights apart in all our lives, and the 2nd time she cried so hard that she threw up. I hope she's sleeping easy now. When she doesn't, she gets bags under her eyelids you could carry water in. It seemed as though a response was expected, but you did not want to speak of dead twins. You simply said, I have always slept alone. You don't say. You heard the primness in your voice when you said,
I am betrothed to the locked tomb, Tridentarius. I slept on a cot in my cell.
I always forget you were an honest-to-God nun, and 6 years old to boot, if you listen to Mercy Morn. How old are you really, Harry?
18, and my tolerance for Harry wears thin.
18, she said, in the tones of the jaded, fagged-out socialite. I remember being 18.
You are 22.
It's a universe away from 18. You lay in that bed like a marble sculpture, your body remote and far away. Sleep and safety had blunted your panic, but not arrested it wholesale. If Ianthe reached out to touch your arm, you were afraid you might not understand whose arm she was touching. You were so afraid she might touch you. You were so afraid anyone might touch you. You had always been afraid of anyone touching you, and had not known your longing flinch was so obvious to those who tried it. But she did not touch you. Instead, sleepily, she asked, "Do you really keep all those letters on you?" Since you were living in exile from your room, they were now tucked into hollow capsules within your exoskeleton, the location of each of the 22 locked into your memory like so many theorems. You'd tried just tucking them into your robes, but you'd rustled. "Yes," you said, and did not elaborate. Then she startled you by asking, "Any regrets, Harrow Hog?"
"About?"
"About any of this. Going to Canaan House, becoming a lictor, coming to the Mithraeum." You were not at all certain.
"No."
"No, I suppose not," she said thickly. "You were more far-sighted than I was. Me? I've never regretted anything as a rule. Good night." For a long time in the darkness, you wondered at that, her good night hanging unanswered. "You were more far-sighted than I was." It was the easiest compliment to you that had ever passed her lips. You did not set store by compliments. It was vanity to accept them, and patronizing to give them. But this one echoed in your head. "You were more far-sighted than I was." You looked at Cyrus the First's cavalier before you closed your eyes, though not to appreciate her details. You were more struck by the idea that she must have died back at Canaan House, when the work was finished, when the lictoral theorem had been cracked. Her necromancer had brought these ghoulish remembrances on purpose. He had surrounded himself with pictures he had painted of him and of the cavalier whose soul now fueled the battery of his heart. You were lucky that the memory of your own cavalier did not hurt you, except sometimes in the form of a sick headache in your temples or in words stuck on repeat in your head. Some of those words were eating at you now, and you recited them to yourself in the quietude of your brain. "Warrior proud of the third house, ride forth now as my sister. Ride we to death and the proving. Ride we with heads held high. We shall bloody our blades in the foe's heart. Death shall we bring to the foul ones. Death shall we win for ourselves as the prize for our high deeds done on the ash-choked plains of the ravens." Book 11, Matthias Nonius and the Cavalier Secondary of the Third House would proceed to destroy a whole legion in exhaustive detail, after which the grievously injured daughter of the Third had to be carried over a Thanagy-irradiated desert, while Nonius mused aloud on the nature of fate all the way into Book 12. You fell asleep. By the next afternoon, an envelope had been slipped under Ianthe's door. It was paper of a deep, creamy brown and sealed with wax. When Ianthe broke it open, you peered over her elbow at the contents. a single page. Also real paper. Also dyed a creamy tan colour. Lettered artistically in flawless handwriting and deep blue ink. Augustine I, lictor of the Great Resurrection, founder of the court of Coniortus, first saint to serve the king undying, requests the honour of the presence of his youngest sisters, Ianthe I, eighth saint to serve the king undying, and Heroharch I, ninth saint to serve the king undying. Dinner will be served at 30 minutes past evening commencement. Attire, formal or ceremonial dress. Your head pounded with a tedious recognition. No, you said. Ianthe tapped your shoulder with the invitation in her usual parody of playfulness, which was a little like being batted around by a predator while still alive. This is the plan, Harrowharch. Just sit back and watch my teacher work. You said, I do not understand the faith you place in that man. It was no good. You would have preferred a time that was not hours hence. You would have preferred a plan that did not involve a formal invitation, a dress code, or dinner. The last dinner you had attended had not gone exactly to plan, and you thought another dinner in poor taste. But you had not reckoned on your roommate, who, as a princess of the third house, thought of dinners the way you thought of morning orison. I still have my robes of office, you said, as she tore apart her wardrobe, fingering each article therein before tossing it aside. It's no longer your office, no. No. It's technically correct. Not this time, my child. I'm sick of being associated with a half-snapped stick of licorice dressed in a tent. No. Hideous. Not even Corona would wear that. No. No. My shirt and trousers will suffice then, beneath my Canaanite whites. Even worse, said Ianthe, and wrestled from its housing what appeared to be a full tulle skirt in midnight purple. Skirt and woman scuffled momentarily before she heaved it across the room. No. Yes, for a different and much better party. No. No. Sometimes I think the Emperor of the Nine Houses favours you because you've got the same taste in clothes. God, what's this? That's a bit risque. You grew desperate. Let me pick. Ianthe looked at you. Her blue and brown eyes were beatific. Harry, she said, and she said it tenderly. Have you never read a trashy novel in which the hero gets a life-affirming change of clothes and some makeup, and then goes to the party and everyone says things like, by the Emperor's bones, but you're beautiful, or this is the first time I have ever truly seen you, and if the hero's a necromancer, it'll be described like, his frailty made his unearthly handsomeness all the more ephemeral, etc., etc. The word mulled 15 pages later. The word nipple 1 page after that? You said emphatically, no. Then we have no shared point of reference. Thankfully, however, this is not that part, she said. Not even one of the Emperor's fists and gestures could give Harrowharch Nonagesimus a sexy makeover. Sometimes I think you look like a twig's funeral. In the right light, though, oh, this might do. It's even your colour. Come here. She was holding a mass of black fabric, but no black such as ever existed in the house of the locked tomb. You approached with naked horror. Ianthe shook out a long piece of starry sable stuff and held it against you. It appeared to be some sort of enormous handkerchief. It was not a dress. When you pointed this out, she said, with some asperity, Valency Trinnet was my height, weighed more than both of us put together, and, judging by her portraits, had a body that did not quit. Your body, by comparison, gave up at the starting line.
Take off your clothes. Take off your clothes was an imperative you never thought you would obey. You did not take off all your clothes, but you consented to strip down to your shirt sleeves, because the shirt was long. The exoskeleton provided some coverage, though not remotely enough for comfort. You stood there with your chin thrust out, expecting a steady flow of crude japery, but all she said was, "Will you take off that grotesque skeleton corset?" "No." "What about your face paint?" "No." "I do not know why I ask these questions," she said. She wrapped the scarf around you, pinned it, grunted, then took it away. You were left to sit on her bed, eating one of the apples she had not yet used for practice. As you ate, you watched her, and you reread the invitation while, typical of a flesh magician, Ianthe took out needle and thread and quite happily occupied herself with sewing. She pronounced it very easy, actually, to thread the needle with her defleshed hand. Written on the back of the paper, "My room, 10 minutes beforehand." "Try this on," she said eventually. It amounted to little more than a veil. She pinned it over one shoulder and left both your arms chilly and bare. The material was water thin and slippery. When you emerged from behind a gaudy screen, she cinched the black, scintillating stuff tight to your body. It was not true black, but shot with a deep chemical indigo, and as you looked in the mirror, the shade made your eyes lightless hollows. Above that field of navy black, little white scintillae trapped inside like luminescent filaments growing in a charred corpse, your irises were devoid of any colour at all. Ianthe circled you, tugging and pinning, and you suffered it only because her touch was disinterested and clinical. Neither the touch of her living fingers nor her dead ones lingered. It was as though you were simply her patchwork corpse. You would have been impressed at her craft, except that she dismissed your compliments. "This is nothing. Naberius could embroider you a full overskirt without pricking a finger." This might have veered close to sentiment had she not added, "I wish killing him had given me his needlepoint, too." Your sister Lichter brushed your hair and fluffed it out with her fingers. It was long enough to do this. Only a little while ago you had shaved it down to stubble. It had taken fright and regrown at speed, terribly afraid that this was your lone symptom of Lichter regeneration. You had not cut it since. You would not let Ianthe fill any of the holes punched in your ears with metal earrings or pearls, and you refused all other jewellery, not bone, and so there was not much else to be done. When she finished, you did not look upon your reflection with revolted shock, merely with a dull and uncomfortable distaste. The worst part was your sudden resemblance to your mother. "I am very satisfied," pronounced Ianthe. You said drearily, "I look like an imbecile." "You look just good enough that I'm proud of my handiwork, but not so good that I'll be consumed with lust and ravish you over the nut bowl," she said. "I walked a fine line, and I walked it admirably. Go and fix your paint, your skull's dribbly." As an act of meaningless rebellion, you applied the sacramental skull of priestess crushed beneath the new-laid rock, the least beautiful skull in the canon. When you came back, she was smoothing her hair at her dressing table with a bone-backed brush. She wore a gown of achromatic purple, pale and almost grey, like the smoke from a fire banked with lavender, and made of what appeared to be a few layers of gauze. The back was open, and you could see the fine dents of her spine, her bleached skin bluer and sweeter against the pallid gossamer, and the twin blades of her shoulder blades looked strangely nude and vulnerable to you. She said languidly,
button me up. And you obeyed by sprouting three skeleton arms from the bone-impregnated inlay of her chair, glad to hide her vertebrae. Ianthe wore her Canaanite robe over her shoulders, but did not slip her arms into the sleeves. You were glad for the feeble, diaphanous cover yours offered. She buckled her rapier belt loosely at her hips, your two-hander you carried on your back. As you followed your co-conspirator down the habitation corridor to Augustine's rooms, a prickle of anticipation washed over the insides of your stomach. Just as your rooms bore very little resemblance to Ianthe's, Augustine's rooms bore no resemblance to either yours or hers. His interiors were of dark wood. Floor-to-ceiling bookshelves ran up most of the walls, and the floor was not tile, but deep plush carpeting. It was a much more crowded, lived-in room, and on every surface was a book, or a stylus, or a folded pair of socks. There were Baroque leather armchairs with pale wheels on the arms and seat from years of sitting, and tasteful paintings with wooden frames and a general smell of wood polish and book glue. It was a friendlier room than you had expected, insofar as you had expected anything. The wide tapestry sofa was thick with fringed cushions in comfortable disarray. There were vases of eggshell-thin ceramic on the table set before the vast plex window, currently hung with primrose drapes, shut, filled with, though you had no idea where he had procured them, cut flowers in shades of orange, red and gold. The saint of patience was bent over a mirror above a wooden washstand, wearing a suit of antique make beneath his robe. You were grudgingly impressed by the sight of a historical artifact actually being worn. Black trousers, black jacket, a plain white shirt with a high white collar, very starched. Augustine had combed his hair into a flat cap against his skull, faultless and shiny, with not a strand out of place. Within the collar sat a funny little black tie that was cut in a curve, and he was knotting it into a fat bow. "Nicely done, my dove," he said jocularly to Ianthe, taking her hands and kissing them. There was a tightness around his concrete eyes that belied the good humour. "You put me in mind of a statue of some lost goddess hauled up from the waters, painted lineaments removed but marble intact. Covered in moss, mould and gunge," she suggested, consenting to be kissed on each cheek. "You should see my sister." "You always say that," said Augustine. He looked at you and relieved your mind by not kissing you anywhere. He simply raised his eyebrows and said, "And so the crow can be a swan. Ah, this is like the old days. You should have seen the shindigs we pulled off when we dared congregate. We partied as though it were the days before the apocalypse. I will remember them always. John laughed more then. Mostly at that madman Ulysses and Cassiopeia, under the table because she'd had a single glass of wine. All right, kiddies, shall I tell you how we'll play this?" You asked, "Why are you helping me commit murder?" He checked his little tie in the mirror again, corrected some imperceptible skew, and straightened up. "For reasons of my own, dear girl," he said, with the glacial cheer that seemed to be his first line of defence. "Once upon a time, if my younger brother had deemed it fit for you to exit this vale of tears, I would not have stopped him. But I admitted long ago that Autus no longer listens to anyone. He always did get his own bizarre obsessions, and you could never get them out of his head with a pneumatic drill. He has caused me more pain over these last scant 40 years than I dare to admit. No, there's no question of me barring you here. I'll get teacher's undivided attention. You'll both skedaddle. Harrow will finish her bloody business, if she can, which I am not at all sure of." "She can," said Ianthe, ruining it with probably. And the lictor said, she can try. I once watched that man fight a city. The city didn't win. He'll leave the dinner first and be in the training room afterward. That's his habit. You'll leave on cue.
This seemed nonsensical to assume. You said, he'll leave.
At the same time, the Princess of Ida said, on cue. Won't tell you what it is. If you're waiting for it, our Emperor will smell a rat. Just believe me when I say that when I want Ortus to go, he'll be giddy gone.
This did not make much sense to you as a joke.
There was a brisk knock on the door. You immediately pressed yourself to the wall, out of direct sight if it opened, and Ianthe tightened bony fingers on the shining end, pommel of her third house rapier. But Augustine merely said, come in, linchpin. The linchpin walked in. It was the Saint of Joy. Your erstwhile teacher ignored you, folded into your alcove, and she ignored your sister, whose pallid eyebrows had shot up so fast and so far that they were in danger of breaking the atmosphere. Mercy Morn wore a long slip of peach-coloured silk, and her white Canaanite robe was tucked over her forearms and had slipped entirely off her slender, aggrieved shoulders. She had scraped her hair into a merciless and shining coil at the back of her head, and she had no eyes for either of you. She said,
you have some nerve.
Not remotely. I never have, he said affably. Do you accept the terms of the offer?
Tell me what you're...
Accept first.
I'll accept if you swear on the sword, said Mercy, with unholy eagerness.
He raised his rapier up within its scabbard. It had a bright conical hilt of what looked to be copper, with pricked designs all over it. I swear by the sword of Alfred Quinque, best of men and cavaliers, that the details of your, business will not be told by me, or revealed by me, or let fall from the lips of my mouth nor the pads of my fingers, even though I think it will be the death of us, he added. At this, there was a fractional relaxing of Mercy Morn's frowsled brow. Not relief, but the germination of the seed of relief. Accept.
Fine, I accept, she said.
Then she looked around herself and said,
you do know the children are present. Should I kill them or what?
Ignore them, said Augustine. Better you don't know why they're here. Look, I need you to fully commit to this one, Joy, and if you don't, I will consider the oath I just swore tampered with.
Commit! Commit! She said scornfully.
You noticed she was wearing short strings of apricot-coloured seed pearls in her ears. They vibrated as she folded her arms across her chest.
Stop wasting your breath and tell me the plan.
Once you hear it, whatever you do to me, don't do it below the neck. None of my other shirts are pressed.
Stop drawing this out. Tell me.
He cleared his throat and said, Deus apiti minor. You had a front row seat to Mercy Morn's dreamy eyes going quiet. The eye of the tempest, before she reared back and punched him full in the face. There was not much force in that blow, which barely snapped his head back, but he whitened as though her fist had been a battering ram. He gagged, doubled over his washstand and ejected a mouthful of teeth, a tumbling, plinking bowlful. He held his hand over his red and dripping mouth and closed his eyes, and after a few moments straightened back up, a trifle greyer, running his tongue over his regrown incisors. Minor, he repeated when he could, taking out a handkerchief and dabbing his mouth. Minor. How many times must I say it?
You've lost your senses, she said unsteadily.
You think I am joking, Mercy Morn? They looked at each other. then followed the type of conversation you had only seen once before, between her and God, that exchange of shrugs and words begun in the mouth and aborted at the first breath, and at one point she said, "Gradient," and he answered, "Radial," and then they devolved again into a shorthand of facial expressions. In its own way, it was swifter and less coherent than what you had seen pass between the Emperor of the Nine Houses and her, that lifetime ago leaving the Erebos. But at the end, her hand fluttered around her mouth, and she halfway wailed,
"I'm not wearing the right dress."
"It's perfect. You look like a melon."
"But I hate this," she said, quite genuinely.
And Augustine looked at her with his insubstantial eyes and said, "I understand. Buck up, Joy. It won't kill you." Your gaze met Ianthe's. She had followed the whole thing in rank fascination. Now she quirked her own eyebrows at you in what you had come to understand was, who knows? For a moment you worried that, come another myriad, you and she might be able to carry on such a conversation, that you would know her intent by the twist of her mouth and her exhalation, to the point where you could speak without dialogue. In the end, Mercy Morn said,
"Blech!"
and turned on one heel and stalked out. She flung open the door, said anxiously,
"White wine!"
and with that cryptic epigram, disappeared. The Saint of Patience said, "That went significantly better than I thought it might," without a glance at his sink of bloodied teeth. "Come on. I want one of you on each of my arms on this battlefront. On my right, Ianthe. I'm not clutching that bone. I never did like him skinny. Harrowhark, you really didn't get any height, did you? Lord, imagine being crystallized a teenager forever. Whatever you see tonight," he added, suddenly serious as the grave, "do not get involved." Behind his back, as you walked down the corridor, the Princess of Ida mouthed at you smugly, "Quick, sophisticated, devious."